Hello, welcome by this podcast of the European Survey Research Association. My name is Vera Tupul, and today we're going to discuss a topic that is difficult to measure with survey questions and for which wearables are available. So the big question is, can we use these wearables to replace or augment our surveys? The topic is physical activity, which is a construct that is difficult to measure because it's not very distinct in your memory. If I would ask you the question, how many minutes are you physically active in a day, you probably have to rely on estimation strategies, right? And then it's difficult because you think, okay, I played soccer today for an hour, so maybe you fill in 60 minutes. But then the question is, of course, were you really active these 60 minutes, or were you standing still for a vast amount of the time? And maybe you should also take into account vacuum cleaning or walking the dog. Did you take all those activities into account? So it's very difficult to come up with the right figure for it. And in addition to that, physical activity is a concept that is prone to social desirability bias. So people tend to overestimate their physical activity. So then maybe a solution is, many people have these Fitbits and these smartwatches today. Can we use those figures in our surveys or to augment our surveys? I think there are basically two ways to do that. So one is ask people to have the figures from their watch and put it into a questionnaire, which makes sense. But on the other hand, if you do that, you do see new response effects in that people use rounding, for example. They say, I have 10,000 steps or 15,000 steps. And also concepts such as, for example, calories that are often also presented in these watches. Some people mention the calories they burned during the physical activity. Some mention the calories during the day. And even if you use restriction text to prevent or to make sure that people take the same amount of calories into account, this still remains an issue. Then we have research grade devices that are rather expensive, so you have to buy them, but you can send them out and have people wearing them, for example, for a week, and then people have to send them back. And the advantage of that is that these tend to be very reliable, and often you have access to the raw data, which is not often the case with these consumer activity trackers. But it is, of course, very expensive and burdensome for respondents. And then the question is, are people willing to wear these accelerometers for a week, and what would be the response rate? So big questions, and I hope after this podcast that we have shed some light into the use of these wearables to augment or replace survey questions. Long introduction, but with me are two experts in different fields. My first guest is Ari Kaptein. He is a professor of economics and the executive director of the Center for Economic and Social Research at the University of Southern California. And he has more than 25 years of experience into building online probability-based panels. And I think he was really the pioneer when it comes to that. And many countries have followed his lead with the panels that he built in the USA and in the Netherlands. And he assured me that he is no expert on the field of physical activity, but of course he is a field when it comes to, he is an expert in the field of survey research, and he knows a lot about physical activity research as well. Welcome, Ari.
Thank you.
And my next guest is Hidde van der Ploeg. He is an associate professor at the Department of Public and Occupational Health of Amsterdam University Medical Center. He chairs the section Health Behavior and Prevention, and his research focuses on epidemiology, surveillance, and intervention and physical activity. Welcome, Hidde.
Thanks, Vera. I'm glad you said it. I didn't have to break my tongue on that one. And it's nice to do the podcast and have a bit of a Dutch onderontje, as we would say.
Yes, exactly. Hidde, you of course have a lot of experience when it comes to using accelerometers in research. So we hope to learn a lot about your experiences in this podcast. So maybe to start with you, Hidde, can you, back to basics, can you tell a little bit more about how physical activity is monitored in the general population? So I'm not talking about intervention studies, but just purely the monitoring of physical activity in the adult population.
Yeah, sure. And I think it's a nice to get started and get a bit of a sense of what's out there. I think there's sort of three levels of this, right? So there are countries that do not monitor physical activity. There are countries that use questionnaires like the examples you were giving earlier. And there are a very small amount of countries where they actually use the more research grade device-based assessments. So basically accelerometers. Maybe to start with the questionnaire. So what you see is that in the Netherlands, for example, we use the SQOSH questionnaire, but different countries tend to use different types of questionnaires, which are usually recall questionnaires for a usual week or 7 days. And people get asked a set of questions, usually around how much they're walking, how much they're doing sports, and maybe physical activity in different domains, such as transportation, household, leisure time, of course, but also during work or during study. Then there is a very select number of countries where they've actually attempted to use the device-based assessments for surveillance. And I'm always looking at Norway because they've set up a really excellent system there where they are for both adults, but also for children. And I think they're up to their third or even fourth wave already. So they set up a system over the last 15 years or so, where they really measured physical activity on a more objective, way using actigraph accelerometers. But there's other countries as well. And some of those countries have only attempted this once. England, Portugal, and other countries have tried this several times as well. So I know there's data in Sweden. So obviously I'm a bit European focused here, but Canada, the United States have different surveillance systems in place as well, such as NHANES in the US, and in Canada, they have quite a few of those as well. So maybe that's to get started, Vera.
Yeah. And what is your own experience with conducting research with accelerometers? Because I think you are often using the ActivePol, right?
Yeah, so we tend to use either ActiGraph or ActivePol, which are some of the most used accelerometers, I think, in research. I know Adi has worked with GeneActive, which is also quite often used, but traditionally ActiGraph, ActivePol, GeneActive are the ones that we see a lot in research. ActiGraph is worn generally on the hip, although it can be worn in different places as well. Traditionally, looking at, for example, the NHANES studies from the early this century, they used ActiGraph on the hip, and most people tend to use that now and use their research protocol is like sort of a standard. ActivePol is used less, I think, in surveillance to date, but it's been really gathering more interest over the last decade, 15 years maybe, especially because it's much better at also assessing sedentary behavior. And also the difference between sitting and standing, which for especially the sedentary behavior spectrum is very interesting to see, because these are different things and have different impacts on our health. And you see that coming up more and more, and that's actually worn on the thigh. And besides that, it measures the accelerations. It's also able to measure body posture because it is on the thigh. And especially the sitting, standing, it picks up much better. My own experiences are a little bit in surveillance, and we work obviously, Vera, with you at the Central Bureau of Statistics, but also in intervention work. So we use questionnaires and activity trackers, such as ActivePol and ActiGraph, to look at how people's physical activity, but also their sedentary behavior, changes over time.
Yeah, and Ari, you have compared survey results with these research grade devices, right?
Yeah, so Rachel, I wanted to respond to one thing that Hidde said. So I think I'm coming at this from a slightly different angle. So I understand that some devices are better than others, and I can see why the ActivePal has advantages just from the pure viewpoint of measurement. My take, or really what I'm trying to do, is using wearables in population representative samples. So for me, ease of use, somehow maximizing compliance, is very important. So I tend to go for the device that's the easiest of all, and then also hopefully a device with a long battery life. So, and of course, the GeneActive satisfies both, because it's really just a watch. You put it on and you're not supposed to take it off until you send it back. And the battery life is easily a couple of weeks, depending a little bit of frequency. So I can see, so to me, there's often in the work I do a bit of a trade-off between, let's say, the highest quality of measurement and the highest coverage of the population that I can achieve. But then having said that, you mentioned the work we did across three countries. So we use GeneActive indeed for the reasons that I just gave. And you started out by saying that I said I'm not an expert, and I will just underline that. So we chose the GeneActive because Andrew Steptoe, epidemiologist at UCL, suggested, and he was actually part of the project. So what we did in three countries, we asked samples to wear the GeneActive, and the samples were a little different. So in the Netherlands, we used the LISP panel, which is a probability-based internet panel in the Netherlands. In the US, we used the Understanding America study, which is really very similar, and for good reason, because I was involved in starting both of them. But then in England, we used ELSA, which is a study of the elderly. That's a longitudinal study of people 50 and over. And that has some effect, because for certain comparisons, you could only look at people over 50, because the English only had people over 50. But so what we did is we asked people to wear it for at least a week, usually 8 or 9 days, because often it takes a day before people sort of start getting used to it. They often put it on a little later. And then we also asked them about physical activity. And we did this in two different ways. So we asked them a very simple question: how physically active are you? Just around 0, 1 to 5 scale. And then also a more extensive question, not very extensive, but where we ask for 3 levels of physical activity: strenuous, moderate, or mild, like that. And then the frequency and amounts, like once a month, 3 times a month, every day, things like that. So we had sort of 2 survey measures of physical activity, and then we had the actual measures from the GeneActive. And so we did something very simple, because we looked at the distribution of measured physical activity in the Netherlands. So we used that as the base. And then we simply looked for the English and for the Americans, where they would rank in that same distribution. So where would the Americans rank if they were in a Dutch distribution, et cetera? And what you find, if you ask these simple questions, how physically active are you, or also the more complicated question, you really find essentially no difference between the US, between England and the Netherlands. Similarly, you don't really find any difference between age groups within countries. So the 30-year-old or the 70-year-old are pretty much equally active if you ask them. But if you look at what you measure, then you see really stark differences. And for example, if you take the Dutch distribution of activity, measured activity as a base, then about 40% of the Americans would be in the bottom 20% of the Dutch distribution. So that tells you something. There is a real difference between particularly the US and both England and I'm saying England because ELSA is only in England, not the United Kingdom. So it's really quite a big difference between what you measure between England and Holland on the one side and then US on the other side. And so and of course the question is then, why is that, right? And I think there's sort of 2 things going on. If you look at the difference across age, then the standard of what it means to be physically active just shifts. If you're old, then walking daily is probably pretty active. Whereas if you're young, that doesn't really qualify much. There you have to run or bicycle or something like that. The other part is that, and we actually looked at that a little bit, is that in the 2 European countries, there is a lot of physical activity that people hardly count. You walk to the store, or you walk to the railway station, or you bicycle to the shop, or you pick up your children on your bicycle. Whereas in the US, people tend to drive their car to the gym, and then they exercise at the gym. So I think there's a lot of it is just daily lifestyle that people don't really realize or don't quite count as physical activity, which then is really explains the difference between a country like the US, where people really use their car for everything, and Holland and England and other European countries where the car is a much less frequently used mode of transportation.
Yeah, and so I read your paper, and I think what I found extremely interesting is the fact that you found an age effect when it comes to reporting. So older people tend to overestimate their physical activity, and younger people tend to underestimate, which is, of course, something that we as survey methodologists need to be aware of.
Yeah. The other thing I should say that and I think we showed, because the paper, of course, that was published a little shorter than what we did recently. So we have this very simple question of physically active eye, but then we also, as I said, we have a slightly more elaborate question. So you can see whether the more elaborate question actually gives you a better measurement, right? So, and it's a simple way of doing it. You just regress the gene active measures on the answers to the question. And it turns out that, if anything, this very simple question has a slightly higher correlation with the measured activity than more elaborate question. So it's not the case, not necessarily the case, that a more elaborate question gives you better measures. Now, of course, that's restricted to just this one example. It doesn't mean that any questionnaire is not useful, but it's certainly not the case that just asking more is going to help. And I think you alluded to that in your introduction, because there is this whole thing of what are we really talking about? And even if you give examples, and how long did you do this? I think there's so many things that come into this, and it's really difficult for us, I mean, as a respondent, to understand what the interviewer or what the questionnaire really is aiming at. And I think so. This is a singularly difficult part of human life, I think, to capture with just a couple of questions.
Hede, you wanted to react?
I did, because Adi started off really nicely with these two topics that I quickly would like to respond to. So the first one was the battery life, and that of course really relates to the period that we feel we need to measure, right? And I think we'd like to have at least a week, with the idea that maybe we should go back one step. The World Health Organization and lots of national institutes advise adults to do 150 minutes of physical activity per week. That's 21 minutes per week. That's about 2% of the time that you're awake if you sleep for 8 hours, right? So a very small proportion of your day is actually moderate to vigorous physical activity. And that's already just walking to the shop or riding your bicycle, as we like to do in the Netherlands, of course. That means it's a very infrequent behavior. And with that in mind, it's good to have at least a week of data. Because if you play basketball on Thursday evening, if you don't have that week, you might not have that Thursday night in there, or you might just have it in there. And it would have a huge impact because of the low frequency of the behavior if you have that, you know, hour and a half of basketball in your assessment or not. So I think usually we'd like to aim for at least a week. So that means the battery life and the memory of your device needs to be able to fit that week at least. And most of the research, the research grade devices are able to do that, especially the ones that Ari and myself talked about earlier. The other thing is, of course, compliance. And this is, of course, very important from a measurement point of view, because it's going to, you ask people to not just complete a questionnaire, but actually wear a device for a week or maybe even a little bit longer. And that can be challenging. And in certain populations, it's more challenging than others. And of course, we'd like to optimize that. I think Adi was very right in mentioning that the wrist is probably the easiest, because you can just put it on like a watch and it's easy to keep it on, maybe even sleep with it. And that's easier than having it on the hip or on the thigh. The nice thing about having the thigh worn is that it's actually taped to your thigh. And it's actually there day and night. It's very, the active ball is a very thin device. So it's easy to just have it there, and at some point you don't actually notice it. So the taping it there, keeping it there is easy. the hip ones are usually taken off during the night. It's a little bit less comfortable. And then you see that people tend to forget to put it back on, or and you have little gaps in the data. And of course, with algorithms, we can screen all of that out. But all the gaps in the data are of course, what we'd like to avoid. The difficulty with the wrist worn, which gives the highest compliance, is that interpretation is a little bit more difficult because of the arm movements that people have, which are necessarily of the moderate to vigorous level activity that we look for. But I think very two important points, and already showing how what most people seem to perceive as a quite straightforward behavior are actually reasonably complex, and already show that small decisions can make big impact on what you actually measure. And of course, there's been done lots of great research on this, and we have our protocols in place, and those all work. And if you're new to this field, I think it's important to realize that there's a huge amount of literature out there, quite standardized procedures, and building your own procedures is not necessarily recommended, because like I said, there's small tweaks, and suddenly your outcomes are quite different. I should probably stop talking about this part and give it back to you, Vera.
Yeah. So I think one of the issues when it comes to these research-grade devices is the compliance, right? Like how many people are actually willing to wear this accelerometer for a week, and what type of people do we have then? Are those the people who are already interested in physical activity or tend to be physically active? And in some research, we might be more interested in those people who are less physically active, or like are on the border of having this 150 minutes of physical activity or not. So do you have any figures to throw at me when it comes to compliance?
Well, so I think there's two things, right? So what I was talking about earlier is that once you've got people in your study, you'd like them to wear the device, right? And that can be tricky with taking it off during the night and all that. What you're saying is probably even more important. So especially when it comes to population surveillance, who are the people who are actually willing to wear that device for you for that week? And we do think that there's selection bias there, like there is for any survey. And of course, for usual surveillance, you know, we'd like to wait the results for age, where it comes from, and Adi knows lots more about that, so he can touch on that maybe a little later. But we never weigh towards how physically active people really are. And it's very likely that if you ask people to join your study, that the more physically active people who are enthusiastic, the more sports-minded people, even though sports is only a small portion of the physical activity that most people get, but you're more likely to get the marathon runners to join than people who sit on the couch all day. And that's, you know, very difficult, because that means in the population level, you're more likely to overestimate population's levels of physical activity and maybe underestimate the levels of sedentary behavior. Of course, you'd like to inform policy. And if you're telling them that we're doing great, but there's huge selection bias there, that's of course a problem.
So, Vera, you read a paper just recently, so I forgot the numbers. I think we actually do have response numbers in there, except I can't quite remember what they are. Of course, from the survey viewpoint, there's also the issue of incentives, and we tend to give pretty high incentives, and that certainly helps. I mean, it's just, you know, just a lot of evidence of these things. So it doesn't, you don't get everyone to study, but that's one way to get people in the study who otherwise wouldn't do it. And of course, there's also a reason why I'm inclined to, you know, choose devices that really absolutely minimize the effort, every little step that counts. And it doesn't mean that, you know, I think there is a place for every device based on the goal of the research, right? And at this point, I'm more, you know, sort of trying to maximize compliance and response rates across different devices. We do more than just accelerometers. And at the same time, and then also see, you know, what drives people, participants and participation. And I think it's clear that there is selectivity. And I think what you said, you know, the active people, of course, are more interested in doing this than the non-active people, even though the devices, you know, typically don't give feedback. So at least, you know, you don't have people worry about the numbers that they will read and that will sort of verify what they always feared, which they weren't active enough. So at least, I think the lack of feedback is probably a good thing if it comes to avoid selectivity.
And if I can add to that, because the feedback part is, I think it's a really important bit, right? And especially the commercial devices like the Fitbits and the Garments and, you know, all those commercial devices, which are really nice for people to have, they actually do give feedback. And
yeah,
I said in the introduction, we are doing a lot of intervention work as well. And as part of those interventions where we try to get people to be more active, to be less sedentary, we actually often give them these kinds of devices to give them that real-time feedback where they can monitor their behavior, do some goal setting and use other motivational techniques, behavioral change techniques, to actually change their behavior. And we know that these devices are quite good, especially in combination with a bigger behavioral change intervention to help people change their behavior. And in that sense, I think it's very important that if you do population surveillance, people cannot get any feedback until they're actually done, like more as an incentive, and definitely not that during the time that you're monitoring them. And I think that's important. And all the commercial devices do give that feedback. You can probably blind it by turning certain things off. But that's probably the way forward, because the feedback is likely to change behavior. And then again, you probably get an overestimation of what you actually wanted to measure.
Yeah, and it may change behavior differentially. So it may change behavior more for some people than others. So then comparison across different people, that also gonna happen. Yeah. Actually, I have a question about it though. Have you followed physical activity during the corona pandemic?
No, there's in my free time, I used to be an editor until last week, actually. And our journal got flooded with physical activity journal, got flooded by corona-based or corona-focused studies on the levels of physical activity. And the really good quality ones, where they're probably linked to surveillance systems, and they've done that in Canada for kids, for example, and the cohort studies, for example, you do see that physical activity went down, sedentary behavior went up. And we also saw that people changed their physical activities. So all the commuting is, of course, was mostly gone. So if you walked or biked or took the train, which usually has a little trip on walking or cycling in it as well, that was mostly gone. But you did see people were more likely, at least some people, to take a walk in the middle of the day or at the end of the day or beginning of the day, just to do some physical activity because they were stuck at home. I think the other thing that is really important to realize is that, especially when it comes to more sedentary behavior and the light intensity physical activities, that which is quite nicely reflected by the amount of steps you take throughout the day. So that's not just moderate steps, but also light intensity steps. If you're stuck in your attic working, and unless you live in a very big house, but if you live in a house like mine, you know, you don't set a lot of steps. If you go to the office and you just walk to the meeting, to your colleague, to the train station, to the lunch place, the baseline number of steps you get just from that is way higher than if you work from your attic. And we saw that too. So I think it was very problematic that physical activity decreased and sedentary behaviors increased during corona. And on top of, you know, the pandemic that we were in, we were already in a pandemic around obesity, one for diabetes, and that definitely didn't get any boost from sitting down in our attics over the last 2 years. So I think very serious development, and yeah, you see that it has all these spin-off things that for public health had much more problems than just the virus by itself.
I just want to rewind back to what you mentioned a couple of minutes earlier. That is the fact that you then just give these activity trackers to the respondents, right? That is like a huge amount of money. And also, I wonder, can this be seen as an incentive also to participate? And is this like GDPR friendly? I don't know.
You mean for the interventions or for the surveillance?
Well, both actually, but I don't think...
For surveillance purposes, I usually, and I'm looking at ID as well, usually you get them back, right? But for the interventions, it depends a little bit on the intervention, but indeed, it can be an incentive. And in some interventions, people actually get to keep them. Also, because we're not just looking at behavior change during the duration of the program, which is usually around 3 months. We're really looking at behavioral change at 1 year and beyond. So keeping that device is very helpful, at least for some people, because some people will stop wearing it after 2 weeks and some will still use it after a year or even beyond. But yes, I think it is an incentive and it's a nice way. And I think Ari was talking about different incentives to actually get people to join your study and actually wear the device for that week that you're asking them to do that. And yeah, this is one of the incentives. Another incentive we often use is just to give people feedback. But again, there might be bias there as well, because active people might be more interested in seeing their results than people who, you know, spend most of the time in front of the television, because they might not be so excited to see that they didn't do too much.
And how do you get that information in? Do respondents upload spreadsheets or?
Well, so in the intervention work, we usually have two sets of devices. So the one that we give to the participants to monitor their own behavior and, you know, as a tool to change their behavior. So the commercial ones usually. And then we also have in parallel a research grade device. And they tend to use that at baseline for a week and then at follow-up and then a longer follow-up usually, but only a sample for a week. And we send that to them or we give it to them, then they give it back to us after a week. So there's two things. So we don't necessarily monitor what they're doing on their commercial device. So you don't have the GDPR thing. And sometimes we do. So in some cases, we are actually able to download that on the back end, and then of course you do need their permission, you know, to download that data. But it depends a little bit on the intervention. But in the interventions, we don't use the trackers for measurement purposes, but we sometimes use them as a measure of compliance to the actual intervention to get a sense of, you know, if the tracker played a big role in the intervention, how long did they use it? When did they stop using it? So we don't necessarily look at how many steps they're getting, but more they used it in week one. What about week two? When did they stop? Did they restart again? And we can look at patterns like that. So it has quite a different purpose. So in the end, I think the surveillance and the intervention work is quite similar because we're very reliant on those research grade devices. So the ActiGraphs, the ActivePulse, GeneActive types of devices. And we use quite similar protocols for them as well.
Maybe about the issue of cost. So as Hilde said, indeed, the research grade, you know, it's also easier for the respondents if you just send it, they send it back. So, for example, the moment they have to download an app, you're already losing people who find this difficult, all of that. So in that sense, and there's still a cost because, like, my experience with GeneActive, quite a few of them don't make it past the second round. I mean, they break down, they don't work anymore. So there's still a cost, but of course you can use the same GeneActive a number of times. Well, the other thing about cost is, of course, and I'm not sure exactly how to do this, but you can say, well, you know, what's the value of information, right? And what's the value of getting better information? And if so, the more we think that the self-reports are not reliable, the more we should be able to spend money to get better data, right? So in that sense, there is a trade-off between that and well, Hidde works in a medical environment where I think, you know, there's also probably more of an acceptance of that you need to spend money to do things like that. In the US, I get a lot of my funding from NIH, the National Institute of Health, and there is sort of the same attitude. So there, typically, money isn't actually that much of an issue. You know, if it's sort of this important, then it's really not difficult to get money to do it. So there may be a little bit of a difference with Europe and the US in that respect. But yeah, at the end of the day, my argument would be, and the same as incentives, you know, you buy quality, and I cannot really prove that, you know, the last dollar spent is really worth it, because that takes a little more, but there is certainly a benefit in doing that. You get better data. And I think that's certainly at this point, I would say it's worth it. Certainly if you think of the diabetes and obesity pandemic.
We are a little bit jealous of that, Ari.
All right. I thought the medical profession always had money, no?
Well, if it comes to clinicians and all that, yes, sure.
Yeah.
When it comes to prevention, we're getting better, but still a lot of work to do.
Yeah, no.
Treating and care still are valued a little bit more than preventing people to get sick.
Yeah,
but
yeah, the US is extreme.
We're in good times. We're in good times. We're getting better.
Yeah.
But Ari, you have sent out consumer trackers to your panel, right?
Yeah. So we have it's a project that we do, and I'm only, you know, tangentially involved, so I don't know all the details. But we started a project where we gave 1,000 Fitbits to our panel members, and if they participate for a sufficiently long time, in principle, this is for a year, but if they do, I guess if they produce valid data for 3 or 4 months, they can keep it. So that, and in addition, we pay them every month, because every month they do a short survey, so they get monthly surveys, they get paid for that, and then in addition, they can keep the Fitbit. Which by itself had an interesting, led to an interesting discussion with our IRB, because some members of the IRB felt that giving a Fitbit to poor people was coercion, because the device would be so valuable to them that they would be forced, quote unquote, to participate. Which led sort of to a somewhat bizarre conversation, because now it essentially says, you cannot give an incentive to poor people, but only to rich people, which sort of seemed to me, you know, sort of turning things on its head. So it took us a while to get past that. But it certainly is an incentive. And it's actually important, maybe more important, to get the poorer people, because these also other people are more likely to have lower education. And these are really the groups that you want in there. So I think that it's really important to pull in these people in your sample if you want to have something that's representative.
Yeah, no, and I really like to echo that, right? So the social inequalities in physical activity are really there, right? And they are there for smoking and nutrition as well, but also for physical activity. And that is a big worry. And in our intervention work, which I talked about earlier, we do try to get the groups that are most in need, and a lot of those are the lower socioeconomic groups, which are much harder to attract to the types of interventions that we're doing. And in that sense, we're going back to the earlier point and earlier discussions around those selection bias, where, you know, we get to more active people to join our surveillance systems. We also see that in our intervention work, we tend to get, you know, higher educated people, usually more women, about middle age, and other groups are less well represented. And in that sense, I think the targeting and the recruitment of different groups is really important. And, you know, we can still get better in that with regard to the interventions, but also, of course, for the surveillance. Yeah,
I agree. Yeah. And as you said, they're always the same groups that participate. And indeed, the one what I find remarkable in some ways is that women always have higher response rates than men. And in panels, men are more likely to drop out, which is, you can tell stories why this is, but it's remarkable and also undesirable, like any other form of dropout.
Yeah. No, and we see that in the intervention work as well. So it's,
Now, my ultimate question is, the future, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, how will we be monitoring physical activity?
Yeah, go ahead, Ari, if you want to.
Well, my dream, I'm not sure whether it's 5 years, but my dream is certainly that these things become a really standard part of the toolkit. And, you know, I think we have talked about it at some point offline. Generally, you don't want to replace surveys. You don't want to replace what people tell you, because there are certain things that only people themselves know, and you cannot measure this just by, you know, having them wear something. So you want to have information about them. Also, if you're worried about selectivity, you want to know something. But I think increasingly these devices become better and they become more cost effective. And I think you do get much better information. Also, if you want to do intervention, you want to understand what policies do, measurement, I think, becomes very important, not just for physical activity, but, you know, for just about everything else, whether it's food intake, which is a very difficult topic, of course, or indeed pollution, or, you know, anything else people are doing. And increasingly, we are able to measure this in improving, with improving quality of what you find. So I think it's just essential for the social sciences to do that, because if you want to catch up with other parts of the sciences, I think the measurement that we do still has room, quite a bit of room for improvement.
Yeah, no, and I very much agree with that. And I think we really need to be better in assessing especially total physical activity. I do think we need devices for that. The same holds for sedentary behavior in that regard. You know, even the guidelines are now really moving towards the whole spectrum of physical activity. So from sedentary to light to moderate to vigorous physical activity, and getting a good sense of that in the interaction between those different intensities is really important. And you can get all of that from the research grade physical activity devices. But also echo your earlier point, right? So there is a lot of information we still don't get from these devices. And in that regard, the questionnaires do give us much more information about types and domains of physical activity, sedentary behavior, and the context. And of course, that's very important to inform policymakers and to see, like the example that we talked about, Vera, with the corona pandemic, how we not just saw the total amounts change, but also the types of activities that people were doing. And if we know that, it's much easier to target people in interventions or with policies to make sure that we see a shift towards more physical activity, but targeting that in their actual context and the actual types and domains people are doing their physical activity.
And then what type of advice would you give young scholars if, for example, they are starting to do their PhD now? What would be good topics to focus on?
I think now Hede has to go first.
Okay, I'll go first. the first is, don't try to reinvent the wheel, right? So there's tons of data out there, lots of very good research groups around the world that have been working on this. And so start with a literature review. See what's out there. Don't go with the first app builder that you talk to that says, oh, physical activity, that's really easy. I know an app and, you know, there's an accelerometer and a telephone will just, you know, make something new. Because they're not the first one saying that. They're probably also not the first one failing in doing that properly. And there's loads out there already. So it's good to think outside the box. But also I think we need to still build on, you know, the decades that we have been working on this already. And in that regard, find out what's already out there. Try to use the devices that are usually used. So there's tons of new devices all the time. But if you're the only one using it, you know, the generalizability of your study is not going to be fantastic. And it's better to stick, even if devices are a little bit older already. The continuity, I think, is important. And like Ari said, technology will get better over time. But of course, for surveillance, we're very much dependent on sticking to our methods over time as well. So there always needs to be either some sort of calibration or at least some continuity and standardization over time, so we don't lose sight of our time trends. And that balance, especially in surveillance, that's very tricky as well.
Yeah, so I agree with all of that. There's sort of maybe two things that I could add. One is, you sort of implied it. Of course, if you have a choice, try to join a really strong group. Then already you sort of get a lot of that for free, because the people around you will know what works and what doesn't, and they will give the advice that you just gave. On the other hand, I think young people also should have the ambition and to feel free to do something different.
Yeah.
Right. So don't just replicate what other people are doing. And I once was at a conference where a lot of young people were then, and the question was indeed, what's the advice? And what they were hoping to hear, that I would tell them what to work on. And I really think, you know, maybe some people should do that, but really young people also be ambitious and sort of be willing to take risk and do something very different. You should ignore advice. I mean, it's just stupid to indeed now go with this app developer has never done anything. But on the other hand, you know, being a little stubborn and do things a little different, I think will also move the field forward. So.
Yeah, no, and I do agree with that. And if you do both, what you were saying, right? So you actually join that great group who does right. know all these things, and then you're going outside the box, then yeah. I think we might have a winner. So yeah, let's join those two in one advice.
Okay. Okay.
Okay, thank you so much. This is the end of the podcast. Thank you, Ari, and thank you, Hidde, for this very nice conversation. I think we all learned a lot, and see you at the next podcast. Bye-bye.
Right, thanks. Bye.
Thanks, Vera. It was great.